Hey friends, happy Thursday. It's Rich from the Unseminary Podcast. Today's interview is with a leader who has been through a tremendous amount of change. I think a lot of leaders talk about leading change. This leader, I think, has led more change than I can think of, than any other organization. And so you're going to want to listen in. Lots of practical advice for you. We also want to let you know that today's podcast is brought to you by the amazing people over at Leadership Pathway. They help churches like yours either begin a residency program or take an internship program to the whole next level. Surely you've stopped and thought, you've been wondering, you've been thinking, man, or maybe you've even been forced, where is the next staff member or the next 10 staff members coming from? Well, Leadership Pathway answers that question by helping churches, again, like yours, develop the pipelines internally through residency programs. Now, maybe you've tried it once, or maybe you've had an intern program, you tried to bring it on, it just has not worked. But Leadership Pathway wants to help you with it. They'll do all the heavy lifting, including the interviewing. They'll do DISC assessment, Strength Finder, all that stuff. They'll chase down all the references and literally hand you on a platter. Here are some residents you should look at. It's kind of like headhunting for residents, but not just that. They'll actually hold your hand for 2 years as the resident is with your church. These people are amazing. They do great work. So many churches have benefited from them. You should reach out to them. What I want you to do is do this. Go to leadershippathway.org/unseminary. And today you can book a call with Dave. He's the lead dude over there at Leadership Pathway and a good friend. You should reach out to him and ask. He'll book a phone call and help you through this. Again, leadershippathway.org/unseminary. All right, well, let's jump into this Change Leadership Podcast. Let's go.
Welcome to the Unseminary Podcast. Are you looking for practical ministry help to drive your ministry further, faster? Have a sinking feeling that your ministry training didn't prepare you for the real world? Hey, you're not alone. Join thousands of others in pursuit of stuff that we wish they had taught in seminary. Buckle up and let's get started with this week's Unseminary Podcast.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Unseminary Podcast. My name's Rich, the host here, and I am so glad that you have decided to tune in today. You're in for a real treat. I'm excited to hear more about this story. I heard something recently that I think is going to have, you know, applicable lessons to all of us. Today, it's our honor to have Dr. Jeff Orge with us. He is from Gateway Seminary. He's a great leader. Welcome to the show, Doctor. Glad you're here.
Hey, thanks, Rich. Glad to be here, man.
Yeah, now I'm excited to hear a little bit about Gateway Seminary. Why don't you tell us a little bit of the story well, maybe start with a little bit of your story, give us a sense of your background, and then tell us a little bit about Gateway.
Yeah, well, I started out in ministry as a pastor, mm-hmm. and then in 1989, when I was about 30 years old, I moved to Portland, Oregon to plant a church, and I thought that was going to be my life's work.
Right.
It went well, and to my great surprise, a few years later, God came calling and moved me more into denominational leadership. Hmm. So I worked as the executive director of the Northwest Baptist Convention for about 10 years, and then 14 years ago, I became the president of what was then called Golden Gate Seminary, mm-hmm. and been there ever since.
Hmm. Very cool. Now, I heard this crazy story from a distance around this move. What happened at Gateway? You guys, you know, it seems like a few things changed at the seminary. Kind of tell us a little bit about that. Let's lead up to what was kind of the environment that you were facing, and then what were some of those changes, and then eventually we'll talk about, hey, what were some of the lessons that you think we could all learn from that.
Well, first of all, the seminary started back in 1944 with the dream of a couple of pastors in the San Francisco Bay Area. And then by 1959, it had moved to a little community called Mill Valley in a place called Marin County, which is just next to the Golden Gate Bridge, like 10 minutes from the bridge.
Oh, wow.
So it was a beautiful location, perched on the bay, looking out over the ocean. It was awesome. Mm-hmm. And we were there for about 25 years until 1984, And then in 1984, the seminary had to enter into a new development plan, and so they did that. And so by 2009, that 25-year plan had expired. The seminary had been there 50 years, had been through two development cycles, and now was facing the opportunity to kind of go forward again. The difficulty was that Marin County had become one of the wealthiest enclaves in the United States, and because of that, the development restrictions are incredibly severe, mm-hmm. More than you can probably even imagine. Hmm. But nevertheless, we went forward with a plan to try to redevelop our property and made a presentation of that and walked into a buzzsaw of political, legal, and community opposition that ultimately included very significant political pressure and political activity, some real stonewalling by planning department officials, and then ultimately even open protests by our community, such that we had protesters in front of our campus for months. We picketed at community meetings. Our neighborhood association formed, it had never existed before, around us. And let me say that when I say a wealthy community, the houses around the seminary sold for $1,000 a square foot.
Right, right.
So we're talking about a 1,500 square foot house, $1.5 million, that
yep,
kind of house.
Yep, yep.
And so these, the neighborhood association formed, hired their own attorneys, their own land development experts, and they really opposed us. And so we continued that process for a couple of years, and then over the – and this is a long story. I'm making very short, but over that period, there was sort of a dawning among us that maybe relocation was a better option. And that was emotionally difficult. It was spiritually difficult. It was financially difficult, because if our property can't be developed by us, then it can't be developed by anyone.
Right.
So it made the property very, very difficult to sell. And so that moved us all the way to 2013 when one day a man walked in my office and offered to buy the property. That's how the story got to that point.
Wow. Let's talk a little bit about – so unfortunately, and you know, and I know you've got connections all across the country, and the same with me. You end up talking with leaders in a lot of, you know, growing churches, or even just in churches. It doesn't even need to be growing. If you end up in some sort of development issues, the idea of getting opposition from the town or from, you know, political forces or is not a unique one. That happens a lot. How are you processing that as a leader in the midst of that? Because there, you know, is this an opposition to push through? Is this a, you know, a sign from the Lord that we should move on? How are you thinking about that and wrestling through that phase?
That is an outstanding question, because all leaders face opposition, no matter what you're trying to do.
Right.
And when you're trying to do land development or property development or facility expansion, you may face some opposition. And I believe in the Bible that the predominant message when you face opposition is press through, ask God to deliver, to give you the grace to stand up to the pressure. And so that's what we did. We assumed that this opposition was both spiritual and political and financial, and we simply needed to interface with it and try to move forward. So we had community meetings. We had negotiation meetings. We hired attorneys and looked for ways that we could go forward. And we prayed much, because we felt like that opposition needs to be overcome. That's how Christian ministry advances. But your second part of your question is really insightful, because what happened to us was, over a dawning of time and through a process of prayer and dialogue with our board and our other key leaders, we really saw that the opposition we were facing was not an obstacle to be overcome, but it was really a signpost telling us to go another direction. And I think leaders should come to that decision slowly. You can't be a coward and run from the first opposition you face. You have to press through, lean in, and make it happen. But sometimes God is allowing opposition to say, I want you to go another direction. And when I started thinking that way, I actually started looking into the scripture and discovering stories in which leaders did change directions because they faced significant opposition. And usually they followed the same pattern we did, try to press through, press through, press through, and then finally say, no, perhaps God is saying redirect. And we did that. And I'll say this, that in our case, because there was such an emotional attachment and such a great, really, upheaval that would come by relocating, it was a slow process for us, and I think it needed to be a slow process to get to the point where we had a community-wide understanding, something else is happening here, and we have to go a different direction.
Very cool. Now, so then, you know, jumping back to the story, this guy shows up and wants to buy your building. That it could be a clear sign. You know, that could be an interesting next step. Let's talk us through that, and what did that set in motion? How did that start kind of change the story?
Well, you have to understand that our property was distressed in the sense that it really couldn't be developed very easily. And so all the people who had, for years, people had made unsolicited attempts to buy our property, and they were all the same.
Right.
We'll give you a small amount of money up front. We'll go into a partnership, and whatever results at the end, we'll pay you. Right. Well, that's a recipe for disaster for a school. And also for a Southern Baptist institution to go into a partnership with all kinds of secular development organizations, that just simply
who knows where that's going to end up.
Never going to happen.
Yeah.
So we were really stymied, because we needed to sell a property to someone who really didn't need to develop it.
Interesting.
So of course we never listed the property for sale. We never put a for sale sign up. We never had an agreement with a broker of any kind. the word was just out there. I mean, we're on the front page of the newspaper regularly about this site.
Right. So, okay.
So eventually, a man came to see me. Mm-hmm. He was the 25th largest private landowner in America. Hmm. Owned over 400,000 acres of property.
Wow.
And was in his was older man, and really when he came into my office, he said, I know what you're facing, and I wonder if you'd ever consider selling the property. And I said, well, you're a serious man and a serious businessman. And yes, I would, but I'll just be very frank with you. We need these three things. I need $100 million cash. Mm-hmm. I need 2-year lease back of the property at a token amount so I can continue seminary operations until we move. Mm-hmm. And then three, I need you to take all future development risk, no partnership of any kind.
Wow. And you drive a hard bargain, man. You drive a hard bargain.
You know, I mean, I've been down this road with so many people.
Yeah, exactly.
There was no reason to, you know, mess around, really.
Yeah.
So I looked out. He looked out the window, thought for a minute, and he turned back to me and said, could I give you the $100 million in two payments so that I could have that on two different fiscal years of my company books? I said, you mean like one payment soon and one maybe in January? And he said, yes. I said,
yeah, I think we could probably sort that out.
He said, well, the other two factors are immaterial to me. Hmm. I don't care how long you stay. And I don't care when I develop this property. In fact, my grandchildren will develop this property.
Oh, wow.
So okay. I just want to acquire it because it's such a choice piece of real estate, 100 acres perched on the San Francisco Bay.
Right.
And he said, I'll take it if you'll sell it. Hmm. And that was in March. And it took us.
Now, you didn't kick yourself at that point and said you should ask for 150, did you?
No.
I'm just kidding.
No, we ultimately We knew that the property was distressed in some sense. It wasn't worth more than that because of the restrictions on it.
Yep.
But basically, it took months after that to negotiate the sale agreement. But I want to – this is another unique facet. We never were adversarially negotiating. It wasn't me against him. It was both of us working together craft an agreement that the community and the politicians and others couldn't stop from going forward.
Right.
And we crafted that agreement. It did go forward. He did buy the property. And 2 years later, we moved here to Southern California. And when I say moved, we uprooted probably close to 100 families of students, employees, and others that ultimately moved with us. And we moved 400 miles. Everybody got a new doctor. Everybody got a new dentist. Everybody left their church. Everybody's spouse quit their jobs. All the kids got taken out of school. And we left. We also built a secondary campus in the Bay Area, and so many of our students and faculty migrated to that campus. But it's of course many pushed forward and graduated, mm-hmm. so they didn't have to relocate. But ultimately, we moved quite a caravan of people to Southern California.
Yeah, this was the part that struck me, that jumped out when I saw this. That, you know, I can't imagine what it must have been like to try to move that number of people 400 miles. This is not around the corner. This is, you know, a significant move, entire markets away. There has got to be a wealth of, you know, insights and learning from that process. What would you say? You know, maybe specific to this move that jumped out, and then, you know, maybe overall kind of leadership lessons that you kind of pulled out of that experience.
Well, the most important thing to take away from this story is this: when we made the decision to relocate, we made a mission-driven decision. Hmm. We worked on this for a long time and finally crystallized around the question: is it better for the mission of our seminary in the next 50 years to stay and fight these battles,
right,
or to make this bold move? And we decided the move was the better alternative. Although we were giving up legacy property, 50 years of memories, institutional identity, we knew it was the best thing for the long-term mission of our school.
Right.
And a lot of times leaders use words like that, but I had hundreds of people, employees and students, who when they heard the whole story and went through the whole presentation and came down to that question, a phrase we use around our school a lot and had used it for years before we relocated was this: the mission matters most. Hmm. And we always try to go back to the mission on decision-making about hiring and about budgeting. And then when it came to the relocation, the same kind of issue. And so I would say this: if you're going to enter into a major change, the most important aspect of it is mission clarity. And then without any gamesmanship, you have to really tie that change to the mission and the people have to see it and own it. And that's the explanation, too, of the remarkable unity we had.
Yeah, why don't you flesh that out a little bit? What were some of the ways that you kept mission in front? What were some of the ways that that ended up driving decision-making, deciding where to go, all that? How did that help?
Well, it meant everything. We have a clearly articulated mission at Gateway Seminary. We restated it in almost a decade ago, and it's simply shaping leaders to expand God's kingdom around the world. That's what mm-hmm. we do. Mm-hmm. And so when we got down to decision-making, I was in a really crucial meeting at one point, and I said, our mission is not winning land development wars. Our mission is not reforming land development processes. Our mission is not preserving. Our mission is not making money off land development. And then one of our other leaders, and a very important leader, had been here for 30 years at the time, he said, and Jeff, our mission is not preserving legacy property or holding on to institutional identity. And then he said these words. He said, if we lose the seminary, but the mission of shaping leaders is advanced, mm-hmm. we've been successful. And then he looked at me, and it was kind of like you could hear the scary music playing. He said, Jeff, you have to sell the seminary.
Wow.
And that was the moment when we sort of knew after 4 years of processing and long meetings and coming down to this offer from this man to buy our property, that's when it really crystallized in the moment. It's really about the mission. Now mm-hmm. that they were able to do that because I had used that statement for years in budgeting decisions and in hiring decisions and in all kinds of strategic ways. We kept going back to that. And that's where that phrase, the mission matters most, came. It wasn't a catchphrase I invented. It was the phrase people said back to me. Mm-hmm. You know, you always bring us back to that because the mission matters most. And mm-hmm. and so when we came before when I met with the seminary, hundreds of students, I mean, we had 2,000 students at the time we announced that we were moving.
Wow.
And they weren't all at one location. I mean, that's everywhere, online and at our multiple yep. campuses. But when we announced that we had that we were moving, we had about 600 students at that campus, and we had 150 employees. And when I called them together and said, this is what we're doing, and I walked them through a very carefully crafted presentation and said, it's about the mission. Where we're going is about the mission. Why we're doing it is about the mission. I didn't have to browbeat them into it or try to convince them about it or try to, as leaders, you know, sometimes try to do slickly sell it to them. I just laid it out and said, this is it. And it's about the mission. And within 48 hours, it was evident that God had moved to bring about a supernatural unity around that statement that it is about the mission. And when I say unity, I mean, we're sitting here 4 years later from that announcement in April of 2014. And this is no exaggeration. I've said it many places. No one's disputed it. I have never received an email, a phone call, or a text, or a conversation with any person who was currently employed by the seminary or currently enrolled as a student in opposition to the relocation. Not one.
Interesting. Interesting. Wow.
And it's because they really saw it as being a mission-driven decision. Now, that doesn't mean there wasn't a lot of processing and a lot of painful moments where people were, you know, emotionally going through what it meant for their wife to quit her job and them to leave the campus and their kids to be taken out of school. I mean, there was a lot of transitional trauma that we all went through together. Mm-hmm. But even those people would say, I know we're doing the right thing, and we'll just make it through this, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of unity we had based on the mission.
That's amazing. That's incredible. Now, you've written a book about this, or you've kind of compressed these lessons down called Leading Major Change in Ministry. Now, folks, this is a gift to your church, because I think although we may not be moving a seminary 400 miles, we all come to these moments where we have to lead through an incredible change. It's probably, normally I would ask, why did you write this book? But it's fairly obvious why. Through this process of kind of crystallizing it, what were some of the things that kind of came to the fore? Because there's obviously you actually did it, and then now you compress some of those lessons down. What were some of those lessons that jumped to you that now you're happy to be kind of passing on through this particular model of, or this mode of this book?
Yeah, Rich, I want to answer that, but can I pick up on just one thing you said when you were setting up the question?
Yeah.
This is a gift to the church. I have been a ministry leader for about 35 years, mm-hmm. and this is actually the fourth major change, I mean, very significant change I've led. I led a church plant, a state convention, and now a seminary. And each one of those has had a moment when it had to make a really significant change. And so the book is really about changes in church, changes in organizations. And it's not just about the seminary, although that's a backdrop. And so I want to say it's really for any leader who's facing a major change issue. Now, to answer your question, so many things came together in putting the book together. But one of the things that I think is really helpful is, how do you know when to make a major change? Mm-hmm. Is it an intuitive feeling? Is it a sort of a sense of spiritual leadership? Is it seeing the handwriting on the wall? I mean, yeah, it's some of all of that. But I thought, you know, there has to be a better way to get at this. So I reflected on my experience and my training and reading about leading major change, and I distilled it into five diagnostic questions.
Okay.
And I'm not going to have time on the podcast for all of this, but I'll just say the five diagnostic questions are: is the change essential to the mission? Is there shared urgency about the change? Is relational trust high enough to sustain the change? Is the timing right for the change? And am I willing to see the change to completion? And I wrote significantly about those five questions in the book, but basically I tried to create a diagnostic tool so that a leader can work through those five questions. And if the answer is yes to all five, then perhaps that spiritual intuition or that spiritual prompting you're feeling really is validated by the working through those questions, not just yourself, but with your leadership team. And in my case, with a board also, to come to grips with the reality, yes, it's time for a major change in our organization. So one of the key learnings was just creating that diagnostic tool to help leaders know when to make a major change.
Yeah, why don't we jump in on even, you know, just picking one of those out. There's a question around kind of relational bandwidth. Do you have the, you know, the relational connection? I'd love to think, you know, to hear your reflection on that, both the experience with the move and then how you're encouraging other folks. It can be easier in a smaller organization when you can kind of touch everyone, you know everybody, you have a sense of who everyone is. But when you're talking about hundreds of students, dozens of staff, what did that look like for you as a leader to stay relationally connected? And then what would be some of those lessons that we should draw when we think about leading in our context?
Well, leading major change requires a two-way sense of relational trust. First of all, most leaders know that in order to lead major change, they have to have the trust of their followers. Mm-hmm. And that's very significant. Mm-hmm. But what I've also written about is that for you to lead a major change, you have to have the trust in your followers, because they're actually going to be the ones who get it done. Mm-hmm. And I knew that I had been at the seminary 12 years when I made the announcement. I'd been at the seminary 10 years when I made the announcement that we were selling the property and relocating. And I knew that in 10 years, I had built up a tremendous amount of relational trust from my followers. And now you do that by demonstrating confidence, by stability of leadership, by serving them and meeting their needs. They knew that I had improved their compensation, that I had changed their work environment for the better, that I'd added new people, that we had grown the seminary in some ways that were meaningful to them. And so there was a sense that the president's out for us. He's on our side. He's making this a better place. And so when I came with this announcement, there was a sense that he has a long track record with us. Mm-hmm. There's a trust that's built by that. Mm-hmm. But the other side was also true. I had trusted them with many decisions in the past, and they had on smaller issues come through, and I had rewarded them and complimented them and given them public recognition, both vice presidents, faculty, and key staff. So that when I said to them, we can do this because you've done things like this in the past, nothing ever this big, but we have a track record, I know you can do it. There was a two-way trust. And I write a lot about that in the book, because I think most leadership books focus on earning the trust of your leaders before you attempt major change, but they don't say enough about demonstrating trust in your leaders and That's building good. Their confidence that they can actually do what you're asking them to do. I just talked with a pastor this week who called for some help with a problem in his church. And I said, Don't begin by telling the church, you've always done this wrong in the past, but now I'm here and we'll fix it. No, they'll look back at you and say, well, then why would I have any confidence I can do anything in the future if I've always done it wrong in the past? Right. It's better to say, in the past, you followed your leaders and did the best you could. Now we're going to build on that. Mm-hmm. That's a much better approach than the one that some take. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that two-way trust is so essential, and building it and then building it both ways is really vital. And then I would say another thing. Mm-hmm. When we got ready to do this, I went to the board and I laid out a number of things they needed to consider. And one of the things I told the board was this. I said, I've been here 10 years. I'm not going to become a better president. I am what I am.
Moving 400 miles is not going to make you better at your job?
Yeah, it's like I said, so you have a decision to make. Hmm. Have I demonstrated to you that I can lead this or not?
Right.
And if I haven't, you need to say so now, because I'm not going to get better in the next two years.
Oh, that's good.
This is what I am. Mm-hmm. And I told him, I said, and another issue to keep in mind is the seminary move is going to be the most traumatic thing that's ever been attempted by maybe any seminary, but by this one particularly. And I think you're going to have a president who's sort of at the peak of his ministry years, and if you want to say it that way. Mm-hmm. I said, mm-hmm. I've been here 10 years, and if this is the moment, mm-hmm. then you need to seize on it. But if it's not, then we need to move on to the next president, because you need to let that guy build up 10 years of credibility so that he can do this.
Right.
And I wasn't trying to get out of the job or say that I was, you know, really the special one for the job. I was just being frank and saying, look, if the trust level's not here by now, it's not going to get here. And if the trust level is here, then maybe that's one indication that God is saying, pull the trigger. It's time to go. And that's what the board ultimately did. Hmm. The trust was important.
Yeah, that's a huge deal. I love the spirit of that. I love the intensity of saying, like, hey, are you with me? or do we need to find somebody else to lead this thing? And even, again, to underline what you said, that is subjugating yourself to the mission ultimately and saying, listen, the right. mission's more important than me as a leader. It's more important that we find the right person to lead this thing, which, again, a lot of leaders play lip service to that, but I don't know that they would push it to the end and say, okay, that even relies, you know, ultimately to me. Now,
it was sobering. I was going to say, you push it to that level. I mean, I stood up and said, we're putting one of the six seminaries of the Southern Baptist Convention on the line. Right. $100 million, hundreds of families. And if we're wrong, we lose everything.
Right.
And so if this is not the right leader, not the right time, not the right plan. And then, of course, part of our story is, you know, the board had discussed this. You know, they'd been working on it for 4 years, and we'd gone through the whole progression of trying to develop to thinking about a different option. And then they spent a year and a half just working on the real possibility of selling. Mm-hmm. And when we came down to the final meeting to take the vote, there was intense discussion. I don't mean negative. I mean, it was weighty discussion. That's a better word. I mean, it was sobering.
Yeah.
And then I told them, I said, I even went this far. I said, you can't make this decision out of loyalty to the president. And a lot of times boards do that because they are loyal to their presidents. Mm-hmm. And especially if it's on a questionable thing, not a doctrinal thing, but just something where, well, it's a judgment call and the president's made it. We're going to support the president.
Yeah.
And I told them, you can't do this on that kind of decision. You have to believe rock solid in your soul. This is the right thing that God wants the school to do. And I said, and in order to help you make that decision, I'm going to walk out of the room and you're going to make it without me here, because it's not about me. And if you need to say that, you need to say that. And I left the room, and the board was in executive session, and they stayed for a little while. And then they came out and got me and brought me in. They said, well, we voted by a ballot like you requested. And we voted unanimously to sell the seminary.
Wow.
And then and it was just like in that moment, I thought, God, by every check and balance we know,
right.
we've used every authority structure we have, mm-hmm. and this is where it's come to. Mm-hmm. And so we go forward, and we did. And mm-hmm. so it was an amazing story of trust being demonstrated on a lot of levels, and not just lip service trust, but gut check trust. Are mm-hmm. we really going to do this? And we're going to stand together. And I'll say one more thing about our board. Mm-hmm. When I came back in the room, the chairman said, and I can almost quote him. He said, he probably said Mr. President, but he said, Mr. President, the board wants you to know something. We voted unanimously, and we want you to know something else. This is our decision.
Wow.
And you will not go down on this. Those were his mm-hmm. words. Hmm. He said, no matter how much pressure, no matter how much difficulty, no matter how much trouble comes, we will not waver or relent. We will stand with you until this is done. And you can know we will always be there. Hmm. And I looked around the room, and heads were nodding up and down. And it was just like they were saying, you can trust us. We're trusting you. Now we're going to do this. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the, I get the chill bumps just telling the story.
Yeah, absolutely.
Such a powerful moment. But this whole relational trust thing, it really was.
That's a huge deal.
Tested at the highest levels in order to make this thing a reality.
Yeah. And I think I want to underline for listeners is two things. One, I love how, and I would expect, you know, nothing less than this, but I love how you pushed right to the edge of like, we are going to do the entire process right here. We're doing every kind of background thing we need to do, all the due diligence, all of that. We're not shortcutting this at all. I think there can be a tendency actually in these major moments of change to just lean in a little harder and say like, okay, let's do something maybe we normally wouldn't do. And I love that you didn't do that. And then the second thing, I love that you were able to ultimately remove yourself from the process and say, hey, like, listen, people, like this, obviously you were convinced of it. You thought this was the right decision. You obviously articulated that, but at the end of the day, allowed the mission to drive. That's amazing. Well, let's kind of zoom forward. Where is it today? You're still working at the seminary and you're still the president. Yeah. So, right. you're not selling cars. So it must have worked. So what's kind of the outcome today? When you look back on that decision, how is it that you look back and say, what difference has it made in your organization today?
Well, we own a $55 million campus in Southern California that's completely paid for, no debt. We have 125 employees working down here today, and we'll have about 2,000 students enrolled in our program this year at our five campuses and our online program. We built a brand new 20-plus thousand square foot building in the Bay Area. We maintain a campus there with faculty and staff and students. We paid off everything. We have no debt, and we had $25 million left over from the land sale. So I put that in our permanent endowment, which has changed our financial structure for the long-term future dramatically. We've gotten through the enrollment bubble.
Yep.
We had a whole bunch of people that took a whole bunch of extra classes for 2 years to try to graduate. So we graduated the most people in the last 2 years in any 2-year window in our history. Mm-hmm. That sounds great, except it kind of when you lose that many people, you don't replace them as fast. And so we've dropped enrollment by about 5%, but we haven't. But when you think about moving a seminary and only having that kind of a bobble,
it's amazing.
But we had record number of applications for this academic year, and people are coming. It's just now we're kind of rebuilding from that large number of people who graduated. But seminary is incredibly healthy. We're moving forward and doing our thing. So it's awesome. And of course we have a new identity, Gateway Seminary. And we moved we moved east of Los Angeles is where we are.
Yep.
In a beautiful setting out here, but it's the desert, palm trees and that kind of thing. So Golden Gate wasn't really going to cut it.
Yeah, that's not going to work.
Southern California. So that's why we changed the name. We couldn't be named for an iconic bridge out here in the desert.
exactly. One, we kind of skipped over all that. There's in the middle of the move, you also had a major rebrand, which is a significant piece. And that's amazing. Well, friends, I know, again, all of our churches, tongue in cheek, are not necessarily moving 400 miles away. But I really would love you to pick up a copy of this book. Where can people get it if they're interested? I do think it'd be a real helpful tool because all of us in one way or another, we're going to face those times where we've got major kind of change we need to make in our ministry. Where can they pick it up?
Well, of course, Lifeway Christian Stores, they're all carrying it, and other Christian stores as well. Amazon, any other public place that you buy books anywhere else, it's everywhere. It's also out in an ebook format. And then this is also cool. It came out this week in an audiobook format.
Oh, great.
And so you can get it print book, ebook, audiobook. It's all out there. Just go to the Lifeway website and you can go from there to the ebook, audiobook places, or you can go to Amazon, probably do the same thing. So it's available everywhere, all formats.
That's great. So just for folks that are listening in, it's Leading Major Change in Your Ministry. And if you type that in, you can find it. That's fantastic. We'll also link in the show notes for that. Well, Dr. Jeff, I've really appreciated this. Anything else you want to share before we move on with the rest of the episode?
I just want to say thank you to the people at Gateway Seminary, the students, the staff, the faculty, because honestly, I was the point person, but they made it happen and they deserve all the credit.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to jump into the lightning round, that part of the episode where we ask similar questions of everybody that's on the episode. Just love today's conversation about this whole Gateway move. It's been incredible. Jeff, what is a book you've read in the last 6 months to a year? Now, this is a dangerous question to ask of a seminary president because, books are like you live by books. But what are books you've read in the last, 6 months or year or so that shaped your thinking in ministry?
Hey, I did a biography reading project at the end of last year. I picked four books. One about Eric Liddell, D. Martin Lloyd Jones, George Whitfield, and the new biography by Jim Henry. And I picked those four people from different eras, different theological perspectives, different settings. And I read them with asking this overarching question: what do they demonstrate in leadership that I can learn from and apply today? And I have to tell you, it was awesome. Mm. And so I would just say that I'm at the point in my life where I still read all kinds of books, but I'm reading a lot more biography now and really reflecting on people's lives and on my life and just trying to see the timeless leadership principles that emerge from looking at life. And then, of course, in context of scripture, of course. But absolutely. So that biography project was awesome.
Very cool. What's another ministry you're looking at that's shaping your thinking and ministry today that you're kind of looking at, interested in what they're doing?
I'm really interested in the growing number of multicultural churches in California. Mm. You know, out here on the West Coast, multicultural churches are growing to be very significant. And when I say multicultural, I don't mean a lot of different people join a dominant culture. I mean, churches that really are blending culture in their worship and their decision style and their staffing. And I'm a member of a church where I'm a minority, actually, and I'm learning so much from that. So I'm fascinated by, and I could name several, but I'm fascinated by the multicultural ministries in our area. And of course, Gateway's always been the most multicultural seminary. Only 58% of our students are not Anglo. Mm-hmm. And that's in and of itself amazing. But I'm just learning so much about that right now, especially being in a church where I'm a minority. It's really been helpful.
Very cool. That's fantastic. I can imagine being a college president. That takes a lot out of you. It's a lot of work, a lot of effort and energy. What do you do just for fun when you want to kick back, relax, enjoy life a little bit?
I love to travel with my family and do anything with them. I'm constantly in love with the San Francisco Giants and the Oregon Ducks football team. And I am in a perpetual quest to find the world's best barbecue restaurant. So if I'm with my family watching the Giants or the Ducks and eating barbecue, life is good.
Now, it's really in the deserts of California, there's good barbecue there. That is not the kind of place I would say, you know, outside of LA. But is there a misnomer there?
There's good barbecue everywhere. There's also bad barbecue everywhere. So man's got to work through the list until he finally gets to the good ones.
Oh, that's great. Well, Doc, I appreciate you being on the show today. Thank you so much. If people want to get in touch with you or the seminary or the book or anything like that, how can they do that?
Fastest way is go to my website, Jefforge, jefforge.com. That'll get you to me. Or you can email me at my name, jefforge@gs.edu, and we'll get back to you.
Great. Thank you so much. Thanks for being on the show today.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to this week's Unseminary podcast. Don't be shy. We'd love to connect. Check out Unseminary Inbox. You can sign up at unseminary.com and we'll send you helpful training resources every week. Plus, you'll gain immediate access to our exclusive members area with tons of resources you can use. Connect with Rich on Twitter at Rich Birch or through email, rich@unseminary.com. Don't forget to check out the show notes for this episode at unseminary.com. It includes links to what we talked about today and more. Leave a comment. We'd love to hear from you. Did you enjoy today's episode? Drop by iTunes and leave a review. Thanks again for tuning in to this week's Unseminary podcast. Join us next week when we'll learn more stuff we wish they taught in seminary.